1983 that I saw you last.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
You haven't been resting on your laurels either. You've been active. How are things, by the way, at the nudist end of the beach?
Oh, yes, you remember that they're still... The topless arrangement is spreading down to the southern end of the beach, as these things will in Australia. And, of course, the beach season is just beginning.
Lucky you.
It was superb there the last 2 weeks. I mean superb climatically, not for aging sexists. It was...
However, you told me some years ago that you had a hedge that effectively blocked your view.
Yes, where I write, and now since I've moved up, since I've got a computer, I've moved up to the top of the house, and I'm even more blocked from a view of the beach, because it's the truth that... that paradise is not a good place to write. You do need a certain amount of disencouraging squalor to write in.
Yeah, I've always wondered about writers who have said, "I have to go off somewhere and write. I'm going to the south of France to write, or I'm going to the wilderness in Montana to write."
Yes, well,
it would seem to me that going to new places like that would be so distracting.
Yes, that's right, because you'd want to ski in Montana and you'd want to drink wine in the south of France.
Also, you have to find your way around. You have to find out where the grocery store is and the gas station.
That's right.
You know, you have logistics to have to deal with that you wouldn't do in a familiar place.
I wrote a lot of To Asmara in New York, and I found that climatically New York was more discouraging of outside activity than the beach in Sydney, because there's an old New Yorker cartoon of a man sitting on a sun chair in his garden, and the house is yelling at him, "Paint me," and the grass is yelling, "Clip me," and so on. Well, where we live in Australia, the beach is yelling, "Enjoy me, don't let this day pass," and it's better to go to somewhere more climatically grim. I think that's why all the best novels come out of, up to now, have come out of places that are climatically grim, and have been written by sufferers of tuberculosis. And
But you do a lot of traveling. I believe you wrote Confederates in Connecticut, didn't you?
Yes. Well, I did the research for it in Connecticut. That's certainly true. Or from Connecticut in 75, 76, in the pontificate of Gerry Ford, and right at the start of Jimmy Carter's coming to the presidency. Find that I can write about Australia in America, and in those days I was silly enough to try to write about America, and I wrote about America in Australia, but it was based on research I gathered on camping trips from Connecticut into the South.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do your research, and you do travel a lot, and you spend a lot of time in a little part of the world that most of us are not familiar with. What's the name of it?
The new novel is set in a place called Eritrea, which is in that, in East Africa, in that rhinoceros horn part of Africa, just south of the Red Sea. And the country is called Eritrea. It was a separate Italian colony and a separate British colony, located between the Sudan and Ethiopia. And in the early 1950s, all the democracies and various other people, America, Canada, Australia, Norway, Sweden, voted to shackle Eritrea together with Ethiopia. And it's been a disastrous shackling.
Was there a historical link between the two countries prior to that?
There is claim to have been an historic link in ancient days, but Eritrea had been since the 19th century an Italian colony, and from 1941 it had been a British colony. And the Eritreans would have, I'm sure, would have accepted Ethiopian control if it hadn't been so heavy-handed. The Ethiopian rebellion or resistance separatist movement in the early 1950s was very small, but the emperor, who is unjustly admired in the West, prescribed the Eritrean languages, abolished the flag, abolished the Eritrean parliament in 1962, and as well as that, the Ethiopian army, which is full of poor, ill-educated, confused kids, committed a number of atrocities amongst the Islamic lowlanders of Eritrea, which served or were intended to separate the Islamic lowlanders of Eritrea from the highlanders and to divide the country. Tyrants always consistently use the same methods through history. This is very interesting. They abolish, they try to wipe out the language, as the British did in Ireland. The British managed to wipe out Gaelic. They knew once they'd done that, they controlled the Irish. And in the same way, the emperor used very heavy-handed methods to try to wipe out an Eritrean identity and to wipe out Eritrean language and culture. Then in 1974-75, when the emperor fell and was succeeded by a Marxist military committee called the Derg, the Eritreans hoped that there might be some recognition of their separateness, but the Derg, led by this man who's still in power, Mengistu, devoted themselves to extinguishing the Eritreans even more passionately. So the revolution in Eritrea became more bitter, more profoundly rooted amongst the people. And this is the revolution which Mengistu had expected to crush very easily in the early days, especially when he had the backing of the Soviets, the East Germans, 10,000 Cubans, Russian satellites snapping the Eritreans. He expected to crush the Eritrean resistance very easily. But now, years after, the Eritrean resistance is crushing him. And fortunately, the U.S. is trying to find a settlement, trying to get both parties together before Ethiopia simply disintegrates under now, pressure from the rebels.
Now, you as a novelist, how did word of this revolution come to your attention?
Well, I wanted to write a Graham Greene-y. I didn't want to imitate Graham Greene, but I wouldn't have been unhappy if the book had turned out as good as a Graham Greene book. I wanted to write a Graham Greene-y moral tale about the connection between politics and famine. Because in 1985, where my obsession with this subject began, we were shown pictures of many skeletal people from Eritrea and from Ethiopia. And the message at that stage was that these poor people are victims of drought. I suspected they were victims of politics. And a lot of people, there were a number of dissenting voices in the West that said, no, they're not victims of drought. Drought was the catalyst. But politics was the cause. The crazy war, which has been waged in that region for, at this stage, 28 years, and which absorbs so much of Ethiopia's national economy, that is the cause of this continuing hunger. And the hunger won't end here, no matter what we do. Some people said in 1985, even if we solve this present famine, as we should, it won't end here until we look at the political causes. So I began to speak to aid workers and to politicians in Britain and Australia. No one in America, I must confess, because of the distance, naturally. And we've got a very strong aid community in Australia. And even at the football one day, there's a little local rugby league team that I follow. And the fella I go with is a senator from our state, from New South Wales. We've got a bicameral system like the Americans. And he was very interested in the Horn of Africa. He was the chairman of the Joint House Foreign Affairs Committee, the same sort of committee that you've got in Washington. One day at the football, he said, if you want to, you know, explore this connection between politics and hunger, politics as a cause of hunger, you really ought to go to Eritrea. He'd never been to Eritrea because it's very complicated to get in there. But he'd been to Ethiopia, and he had correctly identified that the Ethiopian regime was a Stalinist crazy nightmare. And when you begin to hear messages like that at the football, you think God is starting to tell you something.
So
they were the sort of influences which sent me to Eritrea.
Mm-hmm.
I approached the local branch of the Eritrean Relief Association, which also exists in America. The Eritrean Relief Association is the most successful aid operation in Africa. It runs food and other aid donated by the Western democracies, generally by, sometimes by Czechoslovakia, but mainly by the US, Canada, Australia, Norway, Sweden, West Germany. It runs this aid in from Port Sudan, which is a very parlous sort of port, very corrupt sort of port in the Sudan. And it runs it in on in Mercedes trucks, which keep up a continuous passage between Port Sudan in the Sudan and the mountains of Eritrea. You see them coming and going all night, and you get a sense that here is a people, an African people, who, unlike the people of the Sudan or the people you encounter in Evelyn Waugh novels, the Africans you encounter in Evelyn Waugh novels, have taken their destiny by the throat. Now, this whole aid operation is run from offices in the West, in Washington and New York and Sydney and Toronto and so on. And I approached the Sydney branch of ERA, which was run by a very persuasive Eritrean, and I found it was like falling into the hands of B'nai B'rith. They never let go of you, you know. I was then asked to write some journalism on the subject, both by the Australian newspapers and by the New York Times Colour magazine.
So the Eritreans were anxious and grateful for the attention.
Absolutely. They are very anxious for attention. They have about 200 to 300 Westerners visit them every year. All those Westerners have to go in by a complicated route from Khartoum to Port Sudan and then into the mountains by truck, into Eritrea by truck at night because of the bombing by daytime, the bombing by Ethiopian MiGs and Antonovs. And logistically, it doesn't favor the attention of the West. Logistically, it's very... The last time I went back, I went with a camera crew, and it's very difficult. The first thing a camera crew does is send their first reel out so they can get their get it developed and check the quality of their stock, check that it's okay. Well, you can't do that from Eritrea. You can't phone out a story. When you go in, that's the last that's seen of you, and when you come out, that's the first that's seen of you. and you have to file any stories. The first place you can do it is probably from Khartoum in the Sudan. And so, given that it's logistically difficult to cover that war, and what's more remarkable, that society that's emerged in the caves and dry stone bunkers of Eritrea, given that difficulty, the ignorance of the West about what's happening there is partly explained. In Eritrea last year, for example, the Ethiopian army wasted, threw away the lives of 60,000 young Ethiopians. The Eritreans killed in battle 60,000 young Ethiopians. And barely a word of these massive battles on a scale similar to World War II battles was heard. This is a casualty rate 10,000 more fatalities than the U.S. suffered in the whole of Vietnam. And we can see the trauma that that war still exercises in the American social conscience and in the American body politic. So the scope of that war is quite outrageous, and yet it goes largely unreported.
Yes, it's really an unknown war. But into Asmara, you bring together four people, Darcy, the Australian, Christine, the young French girl, the American...
Henry.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't you have made Henry a Canadian or someone else? He's certainly the least appetizing character in the book. Why an American? I mean, there are other villains, you know.
Yes, indeed. This isn't a message to America. This isn't intended to be a message to America. I am a devout admirer of the American soul. I've had a very enjoyable year at New York University. I tend to find, if America is ever portrayed as a cosmic baddie, I tend to find my position in favor of a defense rather than an attack.
I was just getting, of course, you have, as a novelist, you have a right to make a villain any nationality you choose.
Yes, and Henry is based on a couple of sort of cowboy UNICEF well diggers and a couple of cowboy American aid workers whom I met in the Sudan, who seemed to be very interesting. Like Henry in the novel, they can't relate to the developed world anymore. They can't relate to where they come from. And yet they have developed a profound cynicism about Africa's chances. And Henry, as he enters Eritrea, which is a remarkable demonstration, this rebel movement, a remarkable demonstration of what Africans can do, brings that cynicism with him and fights against any easy acceptance of the Eritreans having a chance of a future, fights passionately throughout the book. He's also in the position that his girlfriend is a Somali who's apparently under house arrest, so far as he knows, but is actually probably in a hellhole prison. There's a prison in Addis called the bottom of the world, and she's probably in there, or she's probably been killed. And so he is disturbed by love, and he comes to Eritrea, having been told that he's going to encounter the perfect revolution there, but it's a revolution that's fighting against the forces of Ethiopia who hold his beloved's life in the palms of their hands. And so his position is very ambiguous. So he is an awkward, quirky character, but it's not one of those... He's not one of those characters who are deliberately American, as occurs in British novels. where the American has always made the ugly American. We suffer that too. I mean, in British novels, the clown is always the Australian. Maybe it's a just rendition, but we don't like it either.
Well, the English are notorious for stereotyping people. Paul Theroux, who lives in London, was telling me that they have a stereotypical American that they laugh about and joke about, which Theroux maintains isn't even true, inaccurate, but they do it anyway. That's their nature.
Absolutely.
They're clannish.
We have...
They use terms like Jew boy and nigger, terms that we don't use here.
Sure.
Ordinary people don't use it. We've driven those terms out of our language and out of our thought. And when there is some sort of racial episode, it makes headlines because it's much more rare than you would think. But people in casual talk do that in England, I have been to London a number of times, but I have not caught that myself, but people who live there tell me that's the case.
Yes. Yeah, we have a comedian who... in Britain, who's quite famous, Barry Humphreys, who dresses up as a wine-stained, gutty Australian diplomat, Sir Les Paterson, who introduces himself in stage shows as the Australian ambassador for the arts, and who then spends his entire show pouring female cellists and belching, and this plays very much up to the British image of what Australians are, and therefore I am very wary in my books, I hope, about stereotyping people, using their race as the sort of the template of what sort of people they are.
Now, your party of four, including the English superwoman, she's a woman that almost everybody admires, a dame or a lady, I can't remember exactly.
Yes, she's the wife of a deceased life peer, and her name is Lady Julia. And she has been campaigning all her life against the mutilation of women. She's lived largely in the Sudan. And it is true that in the Sudan, women are routinely mutilated in childhood, and that this throughout their lives has a disastrous impact on their psychological life and on their general health. It has a bearing on their obstetrical and gynecological health. It has a bearing on their, perhaps I'm not using the right word. I was going to say a bearing on their childbearing, if you forgive that repetition. And it contributes, along with hunger, to their early deaths.
The sexual mutilation plays a big role in To Ask Mara, but what is it, how does it manifest itself? What do they do exactly?
Well, virtually the entire sensitive tissue of a woman's sexual organs are cut out in childhood.
So they remove the clitoris.
The clitoris, and a great part of the labia. The more traditional the people, the more they cut. And then they sew the wound up and let it heal. Now, of course, as Lady Julia says, Africa's undeclared war is the war that's waged on these girl children. And some of them die of hemorrhage when this operation is undertaken. Some of them die of septicemia. And all of them die earlier than they should because of it. The wound is then reopened at marriage. The woman is delivered to her husband in this condition, and the wound is reopened. And then after pregnancy...
This is designed to maintain virgins until marriage.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's a millennial practice. It precedes Islam. It precedes Christianity. It's been going on in Africa for millennia. And the most remarkable... As Lady Julia says, It was probably the first thing that Adam did to Eve after the fall, because he was terrified by her heroic sensuality. This is what Lady Julia believes. And therefore, the practice is pervasive throughout East Africa. But in Eritrea, it is obvious, both doctors and feminists who've been there tell me, it's obvious that the Eritrean revolution has made inroads into this practice, and that there are whole regions where the incidence of this practice is either very low or non-existent. And this is an extraordinary breakthrough. This is so historic. It's in line with the rest of the Eritrean revolution. It seems that these people are breaking new ground, morally and socially. This is simply one of the indices of the new society which has grown out of the revolution, and which is so exhilarating to experience while you're there, to experience the liberation of these women who wear the bangle of wifehood in their nostrils still, who in our imperialist terms, I suppose, you'd describe as Old Testament women. Very beautiful, very fine-featured, but a face which seems to come to us from an enormous distance of time and across an enormous gulf of culture. And to see these women speaking now common sense politics and talking very frankly about the thousands of years of oppression which they've suffered is extremely exhilarating. It makes up for the heat and the diarrhea and the bad food.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Next, we know that Graham Greene traveled all through Africa and wrote about it, became very ill during his travels through Africa. Did you approach going to Eritrea with some anticipation? Because did you have your shots, for example?
Yes, I had shots and malaria, cerebral malaria, hepatitis of all kinds, very common in that region. Though the Eritreans themselves manufacture drugs in caves in the mountains to deal with these problems, I am as neurotic as Woody Allen. I'd make Woody Allen look like a Congressional Medal of Honor winner. And I got locked in, as I said earlier, to going to Eritrea. But I was anxious. I was anxious about the fact that I'd have to spend a lot of time living and sleeping underground, that there'd be shelling and that there'd be MiGs going over, and that I was supposed to stand still when the MiGs went over and not run. All this was against my instincts and what I thought I'd do. I was quite surprised to find that I took all that fairly calmly. I felt relatively disturbed, but I remember one night during my first visit, which was rather long, when I fell asleep during a barrage, an artillery barrage. I was in a deep bunker. I was with friends, people I'd got to know, and I felt weirdly secure, as Darcy comes to feel weirdly secure. Darcy comes to forget that these people are Africans and he's a European. And his previous experience in Australia of tribal Aborigines has conditioned him even more to feel like that, more readily to transcend racial barriers. But I did forget that I wasn't with my mother and father. I felt I was with my mother and father.
Were you traveling with aid people?
No, the first time I was traveling on my own with the with a guide who was an old veteran, and I was traveling largely with Eritreans. For example, Amna, the woman in the book, heroic Eritrean woman who's been tortured by the Ethiopians in Asmara. She is based on a woman whom we traveled with for about 10 days. And what would happen, particularly 2 years ago when the bombing was more intense than it is now, you would travel by night, and all the aid trucks travel by night too, and people would rise out of holes in the ground as you approached and wave you down, come up to the window with their AK-47s and talk to the driver and say, "Can you give me a lift?" And the driver would tell them to get lost or they could climb aboard. Told them far more frankly than one would think you'd tell someone with an AK-47 and a grenade belt. And then people would climb aboard if there was room, and you'd end up having long conversations above the enormous noise of the road and of the suspension on the road. And you'd meet soldiers, mechanics, bureaucrats of various kinds, and that's how we met Amna. She just rose out of, the woman who is Amna, she rose out of a hole in the ground and waved us down.
Now, you said you felt as safe and as comfortable as if you were with your mother and father, but are you saying that at no time you ever felt any threat to your personal safety?
We had a week of shelling, and we had incidents where bombers went over, and we simply stood still and hoped they wouldn't come back. And at those times, while you were waiting to see if they did another sweep, you felt insecure. But even then I felt, I'm with the Eritreans, and these men and women know this war. Now, unfortunately, many of them have been wounded and have died, and there are many amputees around. And one of the greatest post-war problems they'll have, if Jimmy Carter can settle this war as he's trying to, and if we, through our intervention, the West, through our over-late, over-tardy intervention, can end this war, one of the problems they'll have is the enormous number of amputees in Eritrea, because the more ground they capture, the more they encounter mined ground. And Ethiopian nomads in particular, nomad kids who look after goats, wander into the minefields and lose legs and arms. And so in a way there aren't grounds for feeling safe, and yet if anything had happened to me, I would have felt very surprised. And the second time I went back with my wife and a small camera crew, and again, everyone felt that way. They felt very secure, weirdly secure. So I don't know why that's so, but I suppose it must be like being with a really good officer on a battlefield.
What about food and drink? Did you have any problems with that?
We ate injera bread, which is made out of a grain called durra, which is like sorghum. And I found that very upsetting to the stomach. We ate occasional goat meat, which is the greatest luxury, and lentils, heavily sweetened tea. So I lost... the first time I went there, I was in there for a long time, and I lost 13.5 kilos. But I quickly, once I resumed my normal decadent lifestyle, I quickly put that on again. The second time I went back, things had changed. Again, food was a mere index of all the other changes. There was a greater range of food. There was more food for the foreign visitor. Unfortunately, there's a new drought in that area now, and if we keep the aid rolling, the Eritreans won't suffer too severely from it, because their aid operation is very, very efficient. But for the Western visitor, because of the enormous areas which have been captured, there's the occasional little luxury. For example, now the Eritreans have great quantities of Asmara beer brewed in an old Italian brewery in the capital, this holy capital, Asmara, so that you can have an occasional beer. It's very warm, but you can drink it and imagine what it'd be like to drink it cold, and there's a certain comfort in that.
You were there twice?
Yes, I went back this year, and the difference is quite marked. The Eritreans are very hopeful now, because they've had such extraordinary victories since last I was there. The Amna character, is in Khartoum, and she's having a child. She was stretched over a stone in the hope that she'd be destroyed as a woman. She was stretched over a stone by her torturers. But this is a little triumph for life over darkness. She's going to have a baby.
As you were preparing to write the novel and you were going to Eritrea, were you keeping a journal or a tape recorder? Or what?
Yes, I used the tape recorder as a something to mutter into continually about a great deal of it is about my discomforts and my fears, but also about the succession of extraordinary events one sees, because that's a side of Eritrea I haven't mentioned in what we've been talking about up to now. The extraordinary nature of the society. Actually, I did in connection with the women, but the medical services are so startling. To walk down a valley in Eritrea, which looks like a valley in the remotest parts of Australia, and to go in through a curtain in the side of the mountain and to find in operation a full operating theatre made out of sea containers dug into the side of the mountain and connected with doors, made of dry stone plastered over, and to find there the full operations of a modern history, a modern hospital, and the full operations of a modern pharmacy, including the manufacture of anti-malarial drugs, anti-spasmodic drugs, anti-asthmatic drugs, antibiotics in pill and capsule form, surgical drips. This is an astounding and exhilarating experience. And then the universality of education. The revolution in Eritrea deliberately decided to educate the women. There's a great deal of altruism in this, but they also knew, as anyone intelligent knows, that if you win the women, then you've won everything. Everything else follows. The men and children follow. And these women who have been, since the beginning of time, A, mutilated, and B, illiterate, and C, so oppressed that they don't speak up to their husbands, and they don't even eat at the same time as their husbands. They eat the leavings. The revolution decided to educate them. And so you see education everywhere, in the groves of cactus, in caves, and the impact on the lives of women has been remarkable. So the inroads that they've made on the practice of mutilation is simply one advance. They've also achieved power at the village assembly level. You keep on meeting women who have this antique Horn of Africa look about them, who are swathed in gold or emerald or in white and blue, and they tell you that they're the village legal advisor, that they began being educated in the late 70s, that they became literate and numerate round about 1980, that they then did a certain amount of secondary education, that they then moved off to a regional educational centre to learn law or to become a traditional birth attendant or to become an accountant. And they are simply one instance of a remarkable society.
But then, Tom Keneally, we're almost out of time, but I did want to just ask you about some of the structure in terms of composing to Asmara, mm-hmm. because you went back to Australia probably with loads of cassette tapes, and then
yes.
what happened? How did you approach the novelistic form?
Well, my wife, God bless her, typed up all the tapes, and then I found it hard to make the novel something more than Darcy going through my experiences, using Darcy as a vain cipher for myself. And I found also I had too much material. And the great problem of writing a novel is the selection of material, because so often in writing it's not the exhaustive, it's not putting everything in, but choosing the salient detail, the detail that lights up the night like a lightning flash. And I found that focus which enabled me to decide what to put in when in the late 1987 the Eritreans attacked an aid convoy in Eritrea and destroyed it. It was an Ethiopian aid convoy, and the world said, why would they do that? And the reason they did it was a mistake. They shouldn't have done it, and they've never done it since. But the reason they did it was because they believed that that aid convoy was also carrying armaments, and that both were bound for virtually the same destination. And the Eritrean rebels tell you all the time they've spent their childhood watching this obscenity, the food moving with the ammunition, or else the food being misdirected and never coming to their village. And that's why that attack took place. And I thought if you could explain why such an ambush took place, then you could explain a great deal about the politics of food in the Horn of Africa. So that provided me with the focus of the book. Darcy goes to observe an attack on an aid convoy. He goes in the direction of Asmara to observe an attack on the aid convoy. And all these other characters, the French girl, Lady Julia, Henry, the American aid worker, Masihi, the French cinematographer who's lived with the rebels, a sort of cinematic Lawrence of Arabia, who's lived with the rebels since the mid-70s, he goes also, Amna, they're all tending in the direction of this ambush of an aid convoy. And this is what gives the book its focus and its direction.
That's right. The fact that you were not only able to tell the story of these rebels, but to tell the story of people, individual people, and put it all together, those are the elements, I think, that makes a successful book. It's an extraordinary novel, Thomas Keneally, and it tells us about the part of the world most of us don't know about. I hope this will make us all think as novels are supposed to do. It's a wonderful piece of work. Thank you very much.
Thank you.